You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Guillermo del Toro keeps stretching the boundaries of cinema with each new film, from Kronos and The Devil's Backbone to Pan's Labyrinth and Pacific Rim, and none more so than his latest, The Shape of Water, which opens today at the AMC Lowe's Lincoln Square 13 and the Angelica Film Center, and stars the luminous Sally Hawkins with Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins, Doug Jones, and Octavia Spencer. It's hard for me to do it justice with a simple description, so I will leave that to its writer, director, and producer, who joins us now. Welcome back to our show.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Do you see this as a fairy tale?
It is, and it's the only way you can actually encompass all that it is, because it's an incredibly fluid and malleable and mercurial almost genre movie. It goes from musical to comedy to thriller, spy, Cold War spy movie. You know, it's incredibly, it's a celebration of cinema in many ways.
All the different genres.
Yes, but in a way that is effortless.
But how did you develop the story? As you were doing it, were you thinking, oh, gee, I'd better bring in a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers thing into even though this is so totally opposite from anything they ever did?
No, what happens that is curious is because I have had sort of a two-pronged career. One is big movies done in a studio system like Crimson Peak, Pacific Rim, Hellboy, blah, blah, blah. The set of instincts is very different. And then I do the more personal, smaller movies in Spanish. And there was a resolution at some point during Crimson Peak, actually. I said, I'm going to try to merge these things because I'm not two people. I make the movies for the same reason. And I allowed myself to think about a project that was in English the way I think about my projects in Spanish, make it as personal and quirky and strange.
Do you consider yourself an auteurist? The French called an auteur director?
Well, the definition of that, I think, changed cinema, and it really made it, in terms of the conducting of this symphony, more director-centered, and I like it because A is the professionals I admire, Hitchcock, Buñuel, Scorsese, all these are auteurists. But the way I exert my craft is by saying, look, we all serve the movie. Now, the secret is only I talk to the movie. You know, I can tell you what the movie said. I hold the Ten Commandments, but the movie gave them to me at the top of Mount Sinai.
How are fairy tales important in times like these?
They are more important now than before. The curious, the disjointed thing is a lot of people say fairy tales are for children, and they are most decidedly not.
They were written for adults.
They were
writing fairy tales.
Well, yeah, the Grimms were collecting all the lore, all the oral lore, from and classifying it in an anthropological way. But the fact is, the tales were told by itinerant travelers like cobblers, tailors, and so forth, in exchange for a good meal. And they were always to delight the household, and they would make fun of the king. They would talk about famine, pestilence, war. They were meant to be very adult concerns in many ways. And that's why the subtitle of my screenplay on Shape of Water was A Fairy Tale for Troubled Times.
Why did you set it specifically in 1962?
Because it's a movie about today, and I wanted to do it, since I'm doing a parable, a fable, you know, I'm not doing it directly, I'm doing it obliquely. I didn't want to talk about now because we get enough bad news about now.
Although you're dealing with things that are now, like sexual harassment and relating to the other.
Yeah, and choosing love over fear. But if you do it in 62, you have an almost inescapable parallel between the two eras. An era in which the American dream is at play, you know, Camelot and so forth. Vietnam is imminent in its escalation. Kennedy is going to be murdered very shortly, assassinated. And yet, this fantasy of a great America, a suburban America, a wealthy, progressive America, exists if you're the right race and the right creed and the right color.
Did you have specific actors in mind when you were writing the roles?
I did. I wrote it for Sally Hawkins. Very much wrote it for...
It was brilliant in it.
Brilliant. I think it's, a revelation in many ways, because she's stretching her incredible capabilities as an actress to places she hadn't gone before.
Well, not too many people are doing silent film roles these days.
No. And the curious thing is, she plays a mute character that is not a deaf mute. She listens, she hears, and there are physical reasons why she cannot speak. But the beauty is, when we met, I said, and this character is going to have a big monologue and a musical number. Mm-hmm. You're going to sing and dance. But I wrote it for Michael Shannon, Octavia Spencer, and Doug Jones, too.
In the scenes where she... where she interacts with what do we want to call
the acid, the amphibian creature? Yeah.
Did you give them suggestions as to how?
Yes.
To communicate with each other.
Yes, because the curious thing is, the movie tries to show that all the characters that talk, that have problem communicating with each other. And the two characters that don't talk, that are just communicating by looks and emotion and body language, they communicate beautifully. So it all came to them how to move, how to touch. I gave Sally a big Blu-ray kit with Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, and Stan Laurel. And I said, the key here is Stan Laurel. Mm-hmm. Because when you watch Stan Laurel, he's superb. He does nothing and does everything.
Well, the reviewers compared it to Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
Not a bad thing to be compared to.
A beautiful thing.
My guest is Guillermo del Toro, who wrote the story, the screenplay, directed and produced The Shape of Water, which opens today at the MC Lowe's Lincoln Square 13 in the Angelica Film Center. Later, it will open wide, as they say. What's the significance of the title?
It's two-pronged. One is, of course, the male protagonist. This is a river god from the Amazon. He's an elemental god. And he is indeed the shape of water. But also, it came from the Tao. Reading the Tao, it was talking about water being the most fluid, gentle, powerful element in the universe, because it has no shape. It takes the shape it needs, and it breaks through every barrier by just perseverance and flexibility. And I thought, that is love. Love is the most powerful element in the universe. It is completely malleable, takes the form you need and least expect, and breaks through every barrier.
Even if it's interspecies.
Well, it is in this case. The fact is, the embodiment of the other. Again, what I think is fascinating is that the creature is of a divine nature. It's not an existing animal. It's not an ape or a real fish. It's the embodiment of the beauty of the river, both physically and in terms of gentle force.
So when people see connections to creature from the Black Lagoon,
yes,
they're missing the point?
No. That is the seed of it all. When I was 6 years old, on a Sunday afternoon, I was sitting, kneeling in front of the TV, because Sunday for me was church and movies. You know, and in comes the creature from the Black Lagoon on a Sunday TV show. And I watch it, and there's a moment in there of extreme beauty and magic, which is fairy tale-like in its simplicity. It's Julie Adams swimming above the creature in the water, and the creature swimming underneath. And I thought, genuinely, I hope they end up together. And when they didn't, I said, one day I'm going to correct that.
So there are a number of scenes that seem absolutely impossible that you have brought to life, either in the water or the dance scene,
yes,
that looks like it could have been in a Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers musical,
yes,
in black and white, because,
yes,
black and white to some degree is magical in a way that color is not.
What it is I'm trying to embody in that musical number everything she feels about love. And we see persistently in the movie how her and her neighbor love old movies. You know, Shirley Temple, dance numbers, you know, she's fascinated by also technical or musicals and all that. But I wanted to embody old musicals. And what we do is we shoot it in black and white in a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers style set, very lavish, very lush. But we shoot it like Stanley Donen in Singing in the Rain, with sweeping cranes. The camera is very active.
How much is the history of cinema in your mind when you're working out a scene? You've cited four or five directors so far in this conversation.
Well, particularly what I do is I never reference or try not to cite the citations of movies of the genre the movie is in. If I'm making a movie that is a musical, I'm going to then quote probably a horror movie or a suspense movie, a noir. But when I'm doing Shape of Water, I'm trying to quote Stanley Donen, William Wyler, you know, very pointedly Vicente Minnelli and Douglas Sirk, which are things that are you normally wouldn't associate with a movie with an amphibian and river god in the center.
Am I wrong, but it seems that Sally Hawkins moves differently from the other actors.
No, she does, and so does the creature.
Doug Jones.
Yeah.
You've worked with him before.
6 times. And what we did, obviously, Doug is an incredible actor. The creature is physical. We have a suit and a makeup effect on it that is physical, and it took 3 years to develop.
Wow.
2 years to design.
So this movie's been that long
six years.
In the working?
Yeah, we started in December 2011. The seed was planted. I showed it to Searchlight in 2014 with all the designs and beat by beat. And we've been at it. And what I said to them is, you two need to move differently than any other character in the film. She moves almost like a silent classical actress, which makes her very watery, very fluid. And he does it in the same way. So you can see in their language that they echo each other.
And then there are the other actors. In another's hands, the character of Richard Strickland would come across as simply a villain. Mm-hmm. But Michael Shannon gives it an awful lot of depth.
Yeah, when Michael came in, when we met for the first time, even before he read the screenplay, Michael is incredibly direct. He sits down to have lunch with me and says, "So what? Am I going to play the bad guy?" I said, "No, and I'll tell you why. You will be the opposing force, but I'm gonna give you 3 or 4 scenes in the movie that will make people understand your plight, and it's up to you to communicate it." And those scenes would not be given to a guy, quote-unquote, playing the villain.
Despite the terrible sides of that character, is it true that you've said you felt a sense of kinship with him?
Yeah, well, there's a particular scene in the movie where we see him berated and downsized and brutally taken, you know, taken down to the ground by his boss, whom he adores and sees like a father figure. And I've had that particular meeting with a few studio heads in my time.
We're not talking about a Harvey Weinstein here, are we?
No, we're talking about, you know, the studios can be really good, really bad. It depends on how frank and open and immediate you are with them.
The reason I even mentioned Harvey Weinstein, separate from all of the other things, is there were always stories about him wanting to change films.
The movies.
And then directors having to do director's cuts after the film was released.
Has
that been a problem for you?
My experience with Miramax was in 1997. It was Dimension, which is Bob Weinstein. And it remains the Dimension experience mimic. It remains the most difficult thing I've ever gone through as a filmmaker, and I barely survived. But you know, I think it taught me a lot. Also,
two other important actors in the film are Richard Jenkins, mm-hmm. who plays Giles, and Octavia Spencer, who plays Zelda.
Yes.
And how do they fit together with Elisa, the Sally Hawkins character?
Well, the movie tries to be, and I think perhaps it succeeds in connecting at an emotional level with the audience, because all these characters have great love for each other, and each of them also have a love story on their own. Octavia with her husband, which has resolved in the movie. Giles with a pie vendor in a franchise pie shop. He falls in love with him, and that gets resolved in the film also. Strickland with his wife, and so forth. Everybody has a little story that is love, and they all correlate to the central story of Sally and the amphibian creature.
But it's also about them as outsiders.
Yes.
And you
invisible,
as...
invisible and voiceless people, yes.
You're a Mexican?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself a Mexican-American or... Just
no, I'm a Mexican that lives part-time in a suitcase.
So you must be very concerned about the vilification of Mexicans.
Yes, very much so, and even more so in the fact that, you know, when people say this movie is very timely, but you've been at it 6 years, how did you know we were going to come to this?
And you saw it coming?
Well, you say if you're an immigrant, no matter how well-received and how loved you are generally in a country, when the streak that is negative shows up, it shows up. And it shows up very shockingly sometimes, you know? Sometimes in a gentle manner and sometimes not.
I was struck by the fact that your villain, in quotes, Richard Strickland, reads The Power of Positive Thinking. He's somebody who wants to improve himself.
Well, see, that's the thing. He's a guy that operates under his own code of, as he says, decency. He sees himself as a really decent man, an alpha male. And the thing with this movie is that we take all the paradigms of the 1950s sci-fi movie and we twist them on their head. The creature carrying the girl in his arms, which is normally the image of horror, is the image of love. Mm-hmm. The guy that should have been the protagonist in the 50s movie, the square-jawed guy with a nice suit and a gun protecting the establishment, that's the bad guy. The Russian spy that would have been the malign element in the movie is a guy with a conscience, in love with science and in love with this creature too. So, you know, to take the same elements that make a genre recognizable but twist in them, not in a postmodern way, in a really loving way, is what makes a movie, to me, interesting.
Well, congratulations on the response it's gotten so far.
Yes.
I'm sure it's going to be a big hit.
Yeah, well, thank you. For everybody in New York, this is your weekend plans right here.
Guillermo del Toro, he wrote the story, the screenplay, directed and produced.
Co-wrote it with Vanessa Taylor.
Okay.
Phenomenal
writer. Don't want to leave her out.
No.
It is The Shape of Water, and it opens today at the MC Lowe's Lincoln Square 13 and also the Angelica Film Center. And plans are to open it wider next week or the week after?
Yeah, we start platforming the next week. Then a little movie called Star Wars opens, and we're going to platform again that weekend. You know, I think our idea is that the movie has such a strong connection emotionally with an audience. We've seen it play everywhere now. MoMA, LAGMA, Toronto, London, Telluride, Venice, you know. And we know it connects very strongly, and we think people will talk about it.
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
My pleasure. Thank you.